Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Igris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The Education Minister recently revealed in Day One Rakyat that almost half of the SPM students from the 2021 session chose not to further their education. Now, this seems to be a continuing trend given that the year before, 35% of the 2020 cohort opted to do the same. Now, what do we understand about why young people are opting not to continue formal tertiary education? Let's explore. My first guest tonight is Aida Thien. She's the CEO of the Tengku Abdul Rahman Foundation and co-founder of the NGO Closing the Gap Malaysia, which helps underprivileged students continue on to university by providing mentoring programs and support. Aida, thank you so much for joining me on the show. What do you make of this news, the fact that half of the SPM students from 2021 chose not to continue their education?
Thanks for having me. I think that's a question that's on everybody's mind. I think the first thought I had when I saw it was, one, I'm not surprised. And two, I think it would be interesting for us to know what the baseline is. So the data that was actually announced was actually based on the record for 2020 and 2021. It'll be interesting to know what was the trend like before 2020. But just regarding the 2020 and the 2021 change, I think it's very obvious that almost half of the students are no longer interested in pursuing their studies after Form 5. And I think when we have a conversation about this, I think what's important for us to note too is that there's a difference between not want to go to higher education and cannot go to higher education. And I think against this backdrop, I think one thing that's very important for us and hard for us to avoid or deny is the impact of the pandemic. So I think even in our experience as well in the work that we do, we find that number one, there are many students who actually felt like they had to drop out of school during pandemic to support their family, either to do gig work or whatnot, to support or supplement the income of the family. So there is something to be said about how pandemic has change or added a lot of weight of responsibility for students, especially male students after Form 3 of dropping out of school and supporting the family. That's one. But number two as well, it's also considering as well how the pandemic has also affected student performance. So there's a lot that has been said before about learning loss that happened in the last 2 or 3 years. And the learning loss, I think even there are research done in the US as well that I think would probably yield similar findings here, which is that it tends to be that the test scores as well as performance in school tend to reduce during the pandemic or during learning losses and tend to impact students from lower income or higher poverty areas even more. And I think that has a lot of flow-on effects as well as to whether or not they can apply as well as whether or not they want to aspire for university or beyond.
Okay, all right. So I like that you differentiated the cannot go and don't want to go. Let's think through the responses to these two different reasons. With financial pressures, what do you think needs to be the response, the policy response to this?
Sure. I think when it comes to financial, I think one of the things, at least even for the team that I work with, one of the things that we're very clear about is that ultimately it's still the role of a student to decide if higher education is something for them. But important thing which is that students are making choices, even to make the right decision for themselves. And I'm not feeling like they're only left with one or two choices due to circumstances, right? So when it comes to finances as well, what we tend to find is that while yes, finances may be a consideration, another point is also that a lot of times students don't know what options they are after Form 5, right? It's very easy for you to think, for example, that, oh, maybe my only option is either matriculation or diploma. And then if I don't get those options, that's it for me in the longer term for them, compared to a sort of like a cost benefit analysis of you going for, let's say, gig economy work for now. There is no value judgment in gig economy work. I think we cannot deny that that's something that's still very important for students to sustain themselves. But having that exercise of reflection, having a mentor or a community that supports you in making that sort of balance and decision is something that I think is lacking sometimes for certain students, especially if they come from low income backgrounds.
Okay, well then what about the other side of the equation, those who don't want to or lack the motivation? You cited learning loss, and I think that we cannot underestimate the impact that's had on students' motivation and their perception of a longer of education in the long term. What would you say to young people who perceive that maybe a university degree doesn't necessarily lead to a better future, to better job opportunities or better wages?
I think the first thing I would say is I feel you. I mean, it's I can see why people have not gotten is there. I can support students even with applying for scholarships. We had a student who just finished his university degree with flying colors, and he has decided, although he has gotten a few job offers locally, he's going to decide to do a particular work in the service industry as a waiter in Singapore, because Singapore just gave similar pay at 3 times the exchange rate, right? So it was a no-brainer for them. So I understand the sort of circumstances the students are in currently, right? It's you look at gig economy, that's going to give you 2,000, 3,000 or 4,000 ringgit, right, as a grad rider, versus I'm going to go to study for 4 years, and then after that, if I get a job, I might not even get 3,000 ringgit. So I think to this, I understand where it comes from, and I think that's very important for society to understand too, which is that wages need to grow. And it's hard for students to look at the 4 years they've invested in themselves and then say, okay, I've invested 4 years and then now I'm going to go to a job that's going to earn me minimum wage. That doesn't work out in terms of the investment and the cost-benefit analysis. And I think people are practical. No one is saying they don't want to do higher education because they don't want to or that they're lazy. It's people looking at it in terms of numbers and seeing they don't translate. So I think it's important for us, as we're talking about how do we prepare students for jobs and also prepare for society, society needs to be kind of prepared too to pay what is needed now. I mean, if your wages have been the same the last 10 to 15 years, are we any surprised that students are actually concerned and are not seeing the value that comes out of higher education as well?
Well, you mentioned a bit earlier that it's important that students know all their options, after leaving SPM. What is there to do beyond the black and white, either leave to join the workforce or to go into matriculation or into uni in the diploma route? Do you think there should be more emphasis on vocational and skills-based education, providing that as an alternative pathway for students who may not want to pursue the traditional book studying university degree?
Sure. I think my first response to that is definitely. What is important, again, is that people have choices and that these choices does not come with connotation of discrimination. I think for now, unfortunately, when you talk about vocational schools, we still tend to see it as the B40 option or an option for students who cannot study, instead of thinking about how they are actually very valid alternative pathways of education. The same way as there are many alternative pathways to coding, for example, it's very easy now to go on a 3-month, 6-month course and then you can come out and you can become a coder or a programmer. They are all of the same part. The problem now is that I think, unfortunately, when it comes to vocational pathways, at least in Malaysia, I think there's still a stigma that is surrounding it. So that stigma isn't just a cultural one in the sense of like, okay, if you go to vocational, somehow you're a lesser student, but it does translate in wages as well. I think one thing that's important for us to really chart out for people to see whether or not vocational is a viable pathway is how is wages going to grow in the vocational pathway. It's not enough to say, oh, I'm going to get 3,000 ringgit forever, that still does not make sense, right? And I'm still going to compare it with me doing gig work on the side. So yes, we need to improve and get people to consider vocational classes as a viable option. But secondly, I think that discussion around stigma, the discussion around how do we treat experience in the job setting is also very important. Because one thing, for example, that we see it tends to happen is that it's a bit ironic that as a society, we agree that education needs to be cutting edge, it needs to be more project-based, that we shouldn't be looking at just rote learning. But then when you go into a society, we still want people with a bachelor's degree when they apply for jobs, and you could have 10 years of copywriting experience and we would still say, oh, you don't have a bachelor's degree and therefore I can in some way exploit you by offering you a lower wage, right? So in some way, there is some sort of dissonance too in terms of what we say we want of education and what we're willing to compromise and change in terms of the way we look at jobs.
Right. So what would you like to see both in the short term and the long term to address this, both in terms from the government, but also from civil society like yourselves, CSOs like yourself? How do you work together with government, maybe fill the gaps that government may not be able to directly address with young Malaysians?
Sure. I think in the shorter term, I think the Minister of Education did mention this as one of the things that they're looking at, which we are actually really, really supportive of, which is looking at how do you support students with careers that are very underutilized in schools currently. Even my own experience growing up, going to a public secondary school as well. When you talk about counselors, people tend to mix it with an area of disciplinary action as well. Although that's not technically what a counselor should be covering, they should be supporting you in terms of navigating what your pathways are after Form 5. So number one is this, right? It's support to counselors and education to counselors as well in terms of how do you support students better. Some schools in other countries or even some private schools locally as well have proper curriculum and processes where students in their fourth or even their fifth form, they go through weekly or even monthly exercises to help you reflect, right? And it's not just about doing a one-off career fair for you to be like, okay, these are some of the colleges out there for you to figure out. But it's also having that process for the students to think about, who am I? What do I actually want to do? What is value for me and my family? And in the longer term, and how do I achieve that? And it's not just about the short-term view of what happens in the next 1, 2, or 3 years, right? So that's also supporting counselors to do that. And for NGOs like us, it's also helping to fill that gap by providing the resources for it, supporting students through mentorship, and so connecting young professionals and people from the industry with students so that they can have that flavor, number one, or what they expect when they go into society, but also imparting of knowledge and wisdom from those who are older than them. But in the longer term, something that's also very important for us to consider as well is second chances, right? So we're talking about students here in 2020, 21 who has graduated who are not going to higher education, but we need to find a way back for them. Whether it is 5 years later, once they're done working, if they want to consider going back to higher education, whether or not it's an alternative pathway, whether in terms of micro-credential, whatever that is, we need to be able to have that kind of pathways for them to go back into learning so that they can upskill themselves for something better in the future.
Ida, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for making time to chat to me today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ida Thien from Tengku Abdul Rahman Foundation, and we're going to take a very quick break here on the show. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our discussion as to why young people are opting not to continue formal tertiary education after SPM. This follows news that almost half of the SPM cohort of 2021 chose not to continue or further their education. Daniel Rahman joins me now. He's the CEO of the Asian Strategy and Leadership Institute. Daniel, thank you for being on the show. What do you think are some of the reasons as to why there is such a significant number of SPM students choosing not to continue their tertiary education?
Right. Thanks, Mel, for having me on the show. I feel there are a few reasons for this. Firstly, I don't think it's entirely new, because if we look at, for example, the students taking the UPSR exams and then those who are not then in SPM, you actually see a drop of about 40,000 to 50,000 students from within the system. So what this shows is while what we see is not necessarily students dropping out, but we see a general trend of students sort of leaving the formal education system. But there are probably four broad reasons why this is happening. I'll probably say first is I'll frame it as a lack of exposure. And what I mean by this is a lot of these students have gone through COVID, and it's been a tough few years. And you know, the priority has always been survival. Many are jaded by digital learning, for example. And then what you have now is them entering a society or a situation where, and this is the second point, where financial situation, especially among families, are still quite tight, right? At the same time, we see that in schools, there are not enough counselors that have helped walk students through these challenging times. I believe an MOE statistic says that there's one counselor to about 500, which if a counselor met one student every day of the year without leave, without holidays, that's still not enough to handle most schools, in fact. The third reason is probably burnout, where because students are in schools and school has associated with COVID, it's associated with exams and learning, therefore a bit of stress. So therefore, the current government's movement towards more school-based assessment, less examinations is important, but it'll take a while before we see students sort of moderating from that. And I think, you know, the last point to this would be, there are alternative options as well. So post-SPM, students are looking at things like, oh, maybe I could become an influencer, or maybe I could go into gaming, or maybe I could become an entrepreneur, or some might have financial challenges and say, I need to help my parents. So we don't really know the reason. And I think 180,000 is a huge number, but it'll be nice to see the breakdown because there are other dimensions at play here. For instance, the urban-rural gap, gender gap, so on and so forth.
Okay, all right. I like that there needs to be some nuance in the way we frame this. I think a lot of the way the conversations have been, a lot of the attention has focused mainly on the fact that there's a narrative that, you know, young people are preferring to be content creators or gamers or gig workers rather than pursue higher education. I'm wondering how you would frame that narrative or reframe that narrative. Is this a failure of policy to address the fact that there is a learning loss and a change of motivation among young people? Or is this something less concerning, that this is simply part of the changing nature of work?
Yeah. So I would probably say that we shouldn't be too concerned. I concur with you that it's definitely a change in trends as well. I think, like I've mentioned earlier, the notion of dropping out or students leaving the formal education space is very common. The big question now is what are the alternatives that they have in place, right? And in fact, it's thanks to things like the existence of e-hailing services, food delivery, or even gaming and being an influencer that have actually given these students an alternative option to education. The second point to this is we also have to see how this actually help students pursue different experience building opportunities before entering the formal workforce. In Europe, in countries like the Netherlands, it's actually very common for students to take some time off. Now, I'm not calling this a gap year. That's usually associated with a little bit more, I suppose, self-discovery, a bit more fun in that regard. And I would like to think that a lot of the students in Malaysia are doing this because of circumstantial reasons. But I think the third part to all of this is also the fact that we can take this opportunity to rethink and reimagine opportunities and what education means. Just because they are not in a university doesn't mean they are not learning, right? If they are in entrepreneurship, I think that's where governments can come in and help with entrepreneurial opportunities. If they are not in, if they are not in a private college, you could then see this as an opportunity for them to do something else, like technical and vocational education and skills. So this is a failure of policy. Rather, I think it's a changing, evolution of time. But I think what's important is how the government harnesses what's currently happening so as to not lead these students into, more dangerous areas. And a very quick point to this is there's also something we call NEET, not in education, employment, or training. NEET. So in Japan, for example, about 1.2% of the population are classified as NEET. Right, so these are young people who are not involved, who are sort of out of the system. By and large, that's okay if they remain engaged, but a new phenomenon has emerged in Japan called hakikomori, which is they're not only disappeared from the system, but they're also in isolation. So the research has suggested that prolonged isolation could lead to detrimental outcomes like social exclusion, etc. So there's a fine balance here, Mel. While all these post-SPM students are leaving the system, that's not necessarily a bad thing, provided that they stay engaged some way or another. Yeah.
How do we ensure that they do stay engaged? I think that's a brilliant point. What would you like to see to make sure that they don't drop out of the system completely and disengage from society?
Yeah, great question. And I think it's a whole of society approach. As cliche as that sentence might be, while we have seen the education minister making statements about this, it actually involves the entire spectrum of government, the private sector, all the way to the Ketua Kampongs, the JKKKs, because like I said earlier, this is not just an urban issue, it's also a rural issue. So what needs to be done? Perhaps a few things. Firstly, it needs to start in schools. The Ministry of Education probably needs more funding. They already have one of the biggest fundings in government, but the 1 to 500 counselor ratio needs to improve. We need to expose more of these students, prime in their minds what their pathways and opportunities are after SPM, right? Number one. Number two, of course, make education more fun so that they feel that learning isn't a chore. It's a lifelong endeavor. Number three, government really needs to promote motivate pathways. I recently had a very enlightening meeting with the Pinning Skills Development Center where they've got something called Learn and Earn. So these are usually post-SPM students who will then get full-time or part-time jobs with the E&E industry in Penang, which, as you know, is one of the biggest in the world. And they are also then given opportunities to learn. So 70% of time they are working, 30% of time they are learning, or vice versa. So yeah, actually, it takes a little bit longer to complete a diploma or certificate, but they get paid at the same time. So I think this is kind of what we want. It's a bit more funding for government, then there's a bit more TVET. Of course, getting industry more involved is very important. And of course, lastly, we need to look at the issue as a multidimensional issue. So if the reason the student wants to leave is because, you know, at 17 years old, they need to help the family earn an income because of, you know, challenging economic situations, then the government needs to find ways for social security nets to be stronger. If the student, for example, is a female, and therefore the chances of her getting married are higher because, you know, child marriage is still an issue in some parts of the country, then we need to find structures where, you know, we give them the support needed, or there's an opportunity to return to employment later on in their lives. So, like I said, it's not this is education, we should get them into schools or universities or colleges at all. It's really looking at the various dimensions there. And of course,
if I may jump in, can I just ask you, where do higher education, institutions of higher education, fit into this change, to this trend? How should those organizations adapt? You know, you mentioned the length of time that it takes for, you know, formal education. I think for diploma, it's like 2 to 3 years, and for a bachelor's degree, it's 4 years. So that's a very long time. How do you see institutions of higher education adapting to this trend?
I feel a lot of higher education institutions are slowly moving. So for example, there's something called APEL, or the Accreditation of Prior Experiential Learning. It's an absolute mouthful, but it is an initiative by the government. Basically, it looks at experience and allows people to use your experience to further their studies or get credit exemptions. So this goes back to the earlier point. If an SPM leaver wants to work first, they should know that one day if they do decide to come back to education, they actually don't have to go through 3 or 4 years. They can actually shortcut the process. In fact, some of them can do a master's straight away. I think that's number one. Secondly, it's to have alternative pathways. So for example, there's an initiative called 42 Malaysia, which is invested by Khazanah and various corporations. And what they do is they allow anyone who doesn't have any background to come and learn. It's 24/7 pretty much. But the point is, these students can also go into employment if they want to. So it's also recognizing that these are adults, and these adults should be given the flexibility. I think the third thing is also to recognize that whatever it is, education really is the best way for social mobility. All research has shown that. And, you know, any person, I feel at some point will have a longing to improve themselves educationally. Very anecdotally, I was in a Grab about 2 weeks ago, and my Grab driver was saying that he was doing a part-time occupational safety and health diploma at University of Malaysia in Pahang, and he was driving in Kuala Lumpur. And I said, why are you doing this? Aren't you happy doing your, you know, e-hailing services? And he said, well, he's happy, but there's a realization that has come now that he's in his late 20s, that he needs that degree for further opportunities in life. So I think, you know, things will come together. The question is making sure that there's that supportive ecosystem for all these individuals.
Dan, in the minute or so that we have left, can I just ask you, what advice would you give to someone listening today who is not considering not pursuing a tertiary education? What would you say to Temaha?
So I think to the students pada ada di luar sana, whether you are in an urban area or in a rural area, first is ask yourself why. You know, and if you are tired, if you are uncertain, then perhaps speak to your parents, speak to your cikgu, speak to your ketua kampung, find a mentor. You're not in this process alone. I think that's the first. Second, take this opportunity to go to education fairs, career fairs. There's no rush between SPM to jump straight into a tertiary institution, to jump straight into even a job, right? And of course, number three, I think set for yourself the mindset that it's okay to step away from education for a short while, work a little bit, find what you like and what you don't like. And even if it doesn't happen right now, it could happen 3 years, 4 years, 5 years from now, or even 10 years from now. So that's my advice. Or even if you find like you might be interested in doing a vocational course, maybe you might be the next MasterChef. go for it. You know, I think there are all these opportunities available.
Dan, thank you so much for speaking with me. Daniel Rahman from the think tank Asli, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.